Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And, for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.
Hello and welcome to Audio Reads. First up is Douglas Murray on why we shouldn't be hugging China any closer.
Like nearly everything named a scandal, affair, or given the suffix gate, almost nobody now remembers the Dalai Lama affair. But back in 2012, flush with recently acquired power and optimism, David Cameron and a man called Nick Clegg went to see the Dalai Lama while he was on a trip to London. Whether Cameron and Clegg knew what they were getting into wasn't clear. The pair had a short meeting with the Lama at St Paul's Cathedral, or at least in one of those bland conference anterooms English cathedrals constructed in the last century to atone for the splendours next door. Looking like a couple of travelling salesmen trying to flog the Dalai Lama a timeshare, Cameron and Clegg had the meeting and moved on. Not so Beijing. The British ambassador was immediately called in and given the traditional post-Lama telling off. In the wake of the meeting, the Chinese Communist Party announced relations with Britain had been damaged. Sure enough, Chinese investment into the UK went on hold. A trip to the UK by Chairman Wu Bangguo was called off, and the CCP talked about how hurt the Chinese people had been by the meeting. You can do that sort of thing if you are a dictatorship. Pretend to act as the mouthpiece of more than a billion people, not one of whom can hold you to account. But Cameron got understandably spooked and, proving himself years ahead of the game, announced plans to socially distance himself from the Dalai Lama. Indeed, soon he was declaring that he saw no need ever to meet him again. The British government issued an apology to the Chinese authorities for all the offence caused, and normal trade relations were eventually restored. It was the account of the first meeting between British and Chinese officials after this affair that was so memorable. I was told that before the meeting could get underway, the CCP officials attended to a bit of old business. A copy of the British apology was pushed across the table toward the British officials, who were then asked to stand up and read it out loud, which they duly did. Sitting down afterwards, the lead Chinese official apparently smiled and said, "We just wanted to know you meant it." I doubt there is a British subject whose skin doesn't crawl at the thought of someone being so abject on our behalf. But there it is, a nadir of the conundrum that Britain and the wider world has long known ourselves to be in. We always realised that there were price tags attached when dealing with the CCP, and as our politicians have repeatedly learned, the line between receiving the largesse of China and receiving orders from it is a fine one. Other countries have been aware of this for years. On a trip to Australia in 2018, I was struck by how much further along the road the public's understanding of the China conundrum was there compared with in Britain. They had long since passed through their politicians praising the benefits, watched them join the boards of Chinese companies, and then slowly but surely observed the political class back away as they saw what that cooperation entailed. Today, the Australians have an advantage over us. While we have a vast trade deficit with China, around £20 billion, Australia has a vast trade surplus with the country, around £30 billion. Even so, they remain vulnerable to the CCP's normal diplomatic routine of extortion and threats. Towards the end of last month, the Australian government started calling for an international independent inquiry into the origins of COVID-19. This followed intelligence leaks suggesting that the virus may have originated in a laboratory in Wuhan rather than one of the city's famously delicious wet markets. the Chinese response was textbook. The country's ambassador to Australia warned the Australian Financial Review that the Chinese public, there they go again, were frustrated, dismayed, and disappointed with what you are doing now. If the mood is going from bad to worse, people would think why we should go to such a country while it's not so friendly to China. The tourists may have second thoughts. Students, parents, and consumers were also said to be on the verge of once again choosing bat soup over Aussie beef and Shiraz. In other words, the CCP's response to Australia was the usual mob trick. Nice continent you've got there. Shame if anything happened to it. The editor of the state-run Global Times, Hu Jixin, was less diplomatic. Hu took to Weibo, China's answer to Twitter, to describe Australia as a piece of chewing gum stuck on the sole of China's shoes. He went on, "Sometimes you have to find a stone to rub it off." As Britain learned in 2012, the stone that China uses to get rid of us pieces of chewing gum is a familiar one. It involves the full litany of investment threats, and it includes claims, issued from its embassies worldwide, that all criticism of the CCP is motivated by racism. Of course, the CCP has no interest in bigotry. A survey of what it has been willing to do to the Uyghur people over recent years might go some way to countering that claim. But it knows the West is cowed by such distractions. After all, it isn't very many weeks since Nancy Pelosi was telling Americans to visit their local Chinatown, and the mayor of Florence was urging residents of his city to hug a Chinese person to fight racism and coronavirus. Yet, just as surely as Cameron was ahead of his time, so the Florentine mayor turned out to be behind his. We've been hugging China for years now, and it didn't make us better. It made us sicker, and not just virally, but psychologically too. It isn't healthy to have your officials lick another country's shoes, or be told that you're chewing gum on the bottom of them. We need to find a way out of this relationship, one that we all know turned abusive years ago.
That was Douglas Murray. And now, Nigel Fundell, the obituaries writer for The Times, on why there's nothing morbid about writing about death.
In my line of work, I sometimes owe a cock to Asclepius. The ancient Greeks believed that a sacrificial offering to Asclepius, the god of good health, could buy you time. Perhaps it worked in the case of Boris Johnson. On the night he was taken into intensive care, I had the digital team of The Times breathing down my neck. They wanted to know if I, the paper's obituaries editor, had an obit ready to go straight up online ahead of the print version. I was up until midnight making sure we had, updating and recasting our existing one, trying to get the tone right. The cock may have been metaphorical, but it was offered all the same. It sounds a bit ghoulish, I know, but it's odd how detached you get, especially in this case, as I know Boris a little. We're the same age, were colleagues for a while, and even played on the same cricket team. Perhaps the only way to explain it is that obituaries are supposed to be life-affirming, not gloomy or morbid. Elegantly written, short biographies that are full of colour, felicities and, where appropriate, humour. Through anecdote and illuminating personal detail, we try to tell the story of a life and give insight into character. In addition to the who's who facts and dates, we want to know what made the subject tick, what quirks might help them come back to life on the page. The judge who had a penchant for silk underwear, the army officer who took a rolled-up umbrella into battle in case it rained, the surgeon who was so competitive at board games he once made his grandchildren cry by sending a Monopoly board flying across the room. Obviously, there is no shortage of colourful material to work with on Boris. The same is true of Donald Trump. The trouble is, in normal circumstances, it is pointless doing too much in advance for such people because their story keeps moving on. Even after a politician retires, public opinion can change between the time the obit is written and its appearance in print, Ronald Reagan and George Bush being examples. Will history be kinder to Trump than at present? To Tony Blair? What I enjoy about the obituary as a genre is that casting is so unpredictable, with everyone from rock stars and mafia bosses to admirals and archbishops rubbing shoulders on the page. Also, it is a time to reflect on a life and assess whether the person was right or wrong in the handling of their public affairs. It is tempting to confer sainthoods on the recently departed, out of respect. But obituaries should be balanced accounts that are deadpan in style, not bland hagiographies that only serve to diminish the memory of the subject. When does the white lie become part of family legend, or the tall tale told at Christmas merge with reality? One problem we occasionally encounter is that later wives or husbands want to erase all mention of earlier ones. Sometimes it goes the other way. We recently ran an obit of Valerie Pettit, an unsung heroine who had never spoken about her work as the senior MI6 officer who masterminded KGB colonel-turned-spy Oleg Gordievsky's dramatic escape from the USSR in 1985. Instead, she has always maintained that she was just a secretary. In death, the truth about her could finally be told. It's strange how often two big names die on the same day, as with Sir Stirling Moss, racing driver and self-styled crumpet chaser, and Timbrooke Taylor, who died of COVID-19. I rather like these juxtapositions. Tessa Jowell died the same day as Dennis Nilsson, Stephen Hawking the same day as Jim Bowen. While it can be exhilarating, it can also leave you feeling jittery, especially when you're on deadline. The week Princess Diana died, a frazzled picture editor was checking the wires in the Telegraph newsroom. "I don't believe it," he exclaimed indignantly. "Now motherfucking Therese's gone and died." When the pandemic started, we on the obits desk thought we had better strap ourselves in for a bumpy ride. But while there have been many scares, Tom Hanks, Prince Charles and J.K. Rowling, for example, the COVID celeb mortality rate hasn't so far been high. The comedian Eddie Large, the 66 World Cup squad footballer Norman Hunter, and the Marquess of Bath, he of the Longleat wifelets, are among them. But there haven't been too many. For us, it has been no more or less busy than normal. If some good has come out of this plague stalking our land, it is that it has made us talk and think a little more about death. The Victorians, with their love of memento mori, had a much healthier attitude to it than we do. Would they have had the hysterical grief fest in the way that many of our fellow countrymen did when Princess Diana died, seemingly unable to cope with death, either as a concept or a fact of biology? We treat the subject as a taboo. Many of us can't even bring ourselves to say the word, which is why you end up with unlovely euphemisms such as passed away. But it is important to think about death because it gives our lives meaning, shape and circumference. We have no choice but to come to terms with it as best we can, because no one gets out alive. I keep thinking about another recent obit we ran. It was of Ram Dass, the hippie psychologist. "Death is absolutely safe," he said, "like taking off a tight shoe." On The Times, we always try to give the cause of death in the bit in bold at the end of the obit, just because it seems a reasonable thing for the reader to be curious about, especially during a global pandemic. One day I heard a colleague who had been struggling to find the cause all afternoon say to a caller on the phone, "Arterial aneurysm, that's brilliant." But we don't dwell on it. It's all slightly academic anyway because, as David Hockney said the other day, the cause of death is always the same, birth.
That was Nigel Farndell. And last, Susan Hill. She writes about being old in the age of coronavirus.
When I told my 7-year-old granddaughter, over Zoom, how much I missed being with her, I added, "Maybe it won't be much longer before I can see you." But she said it would be some time, as the government are going to stop old people seeing anyone because of the virus. Asked what was meant by old people, she said, "I think anybody more than 54? Clearly some misunderstanding. At nearly 25 years beyond 54, I am correctly classed as old. Some days I feel it, most days I don't. But I am well, have most of my marbles, and am working hard. Age is just a number. Except that it isn't. Those of us over 70 are more likely both to catch COVID-19 and die of it. So although the Health Secretary has corrected the fake news that we must be locked down for the rest of our lives, we will have to be pretty careful. The NHS already spends a disproportionate amount of its resources on keeping us going, so the last thing it needs is more requiring hospital treatment because they've defied the rules. Of course, I will die in the next 20-odd years, but I will try hard not to do it from COVID-19, a nasty way to go. There is sometimes argument about whether doctors should make the best of their funds by reserving radical and expensive life-saving treatments for younger patients. Well, of course they should. Palliative care, making a person as comfortable as possible and giving adequate pain relief, is what matter most in the later stages of life, and none of this should be denied, no matter what the age of the patient. Still, thou shalt not kill, but needs not strive officiously to keep alive. This is not a quotation from any rule book for doctors. It's from a poem by Arthur Hugh Clough, but it applies nevertheless. Simple human kindness goes a long way too, and the greatest tributes paid to the COVID-19 teams have said not only how efficient they are, but how kind and empathic. That should be no less true of staff in care homes. But in the past, I've been a visitor to several where there has been a lack of sensitivity, to put it mildly. I know there are many excellent ones, usually the most expensive, but in general they are depressing places, and the heart sinks on walking into them. Whether or not there is a nice bright dining room and a choice of activities on offer, quizzes, sing-songs, craft sessions. Hairdressers come in, some homes have a minibus for outings to garden centres, wildlife parks or pantomimes. Far better than no entertainment save wall-to-wall daytime television with the sound turned right up. But none of it is of any comfort if the care staff are not caring. I've known elderly residents given every physical comfort and yet be deeply lonely and sad. Brisk cheeriness alone does not cut the mustard for them. Not many older people demand to be respected for their wisdom, deferred to simply because they have managed to live into their 90s. But they all long for a place within their extended family, either under the same roof or close by. Granny flats are an excellent solution. Yes, families fall out and bicker, but family matters, which is not to say that friends do not. We should have learned from our Jewish, Indian, Pakistani and other ethnic communities about the value of a family and the natural inclusion of its older members. Sadly, I don't think we have. Lockdown has reminded me of a lesson I was taught in childhood, but later forgot. The essential difference between need and want. Treats were in short supply in the post-war years, when many things simply weren't obtainable, even if you could afford them. But when delights did become available, I had to save up pocket and birthday money for them. Everybody saved then if they had a spare halfpenny, for the bills, insurance, their funerals. My mother had a tin in which she saved sixpences to pay for her twice-yearly perm. Gradually, the nation became more prosperous, shops filled with inessentials, and special inessentials shops opened too, selling things nobody could possibly need, but were encouraged by advertising and social competitiveness to want, generally tat in one form or another. The tat shops are closed for now. We are discovering what we can easily do without, and it is liberating. The world, which we assumed would only become more prosperous, has gone. Poverty will strike many who, with good reason, never dreamed that they would be affected by it. The phrase wake-up call has become much used lately, also with good reason. They don't make things like they used to. Often just means they make things differently, which is true of films. But now I need the joy of the familiar. And thanks to streaming services such as Netflix, I can watch them in a click. If you don't already know these favourites of mine, do try. I just know you will love them. Ocean's 11. Best heist flick. Whip-smart dialogue. Perfect casting. George Clooney. The Magnificent Seven. The Western to end all. Some Like It Hot. Marilyn Monroe, Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon. What more could life hold? Where Eagles Dare. Second World War, remote alpine resort. Ski lift dramas. Funny Nazis. Clint Eastwood, Richard Burton. Oh, joy. Isolation reading has been slow and quick. The Transylvanian Trilogy by Miklos Banfi is a satisfyingly long immersion into the aristocratic world pre-1914 of the declining Austro-Hungarian Empire. Quick reads are Oxford's A Very Short Introduction To series. I have just read A Very Short Introduction To Medieval Britain, Forensic Psychology, The Habsburg Empire, Homer and Criminology. I am steadily filling the many holes in my education.
And that was Susan Hill. Thanks for listening, and as ever, do send in your thoughts at podcast@spectator.co.uk. Join us again next week.
Try 4 weeks of The Spectator absolutely free. And, for this month only, you'll receive a Spectator wireless phone charger. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/charger.